Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by contributors from community radio stations across Canada. This episode of Groundwire was produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabeg-Akin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota. I'm your host, Michael Welch. On today's show...
Coercive process that is designed to coerce the community into supporting the project.
Women coming from marginalized or racialized communities were not heard, and so we wanted to be visible. We wanted our voices to be heard.
But first, here are the headlines. Our first headline comes from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabeg-Akin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota. On Thursday, March 7th, the province of Manitoba introduced its 2019 budget. One big highlight is meeting an election campaign promise to reduce the provincial sales tax by 1%. The government claims the budget will contribute to economic and job growth. The provincial budget comes 1 week after the tabling of the City of Winnipeg's budget, which calls for an increase in property taxes of 2.33% and significant spending cutbacks on road funding. Lynn Fernandez, a researcher with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives Manitoba office, believes that the tendencies toward austerity exhibited at the provincial level is coming at the detriment of average and vulnerable Manitobans and compromises planning for the future.
We cannot continually have tax decreases, tax freezes, decreases, and expect to maintain services. When you go spend 8 hours working in an emergency room, or you don't have access to a cardiac surgeon, or your tuition, university tuition goes up, more than that $50 that you've got in your pocket. So, or you've got to get your car repaired because the pothole is that you just drove through has destroyed your axle. I mean, these things add up to much more benefit than you're going to get from this on an individual basis insignificant tax decrease.
Catherine Fisher of CJLY on Sinaik's traditional territory in BC brings us the following headline.
BC Attorney General David Eby announced an independent review of BC's legal aid service delivery system in October 2018 and tasked lawyer Jamie McLaren with producing a report. McLaren's report, called Roads to Revival, was released this month. The report notes, years of underfunding and shifting political priorities have taken their toll on the range and quality of legal aid services in British Columbia, and especially on the people who need them. McLaren recommends the development of community legal clinics providing family law and poverty law services, specialty clinics, Indigenous justice centers, an experimental criminal law office, and a major case team of lawyers and paralegals specializing in long and complex criminal cases. The Ministry of the Attorney General says it is now reviewing the report's recommendations before it determines next steps.
Our next headline comes from Will Anderson at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on unceded Kanien-Kahaka territory.
Canadian jet manufacturer Bombardier is in hot water again due to potentially unethical business practices. The Montreal-based company accepted $42.5 million from a firm based in the British Virgin Islands called Flashback Services. An organized crime watchdog group based in Eastern Europe obtained files linking Flashback Services to a group of Russian shell companies. These companies, in turn, are known to be part of a consortium, known as the Troika Laundromat, an illegal international money laundering service run by bankers closely linked to Russian President Vladimir Putin. This laundromat has been responsible for nearly $9 billion in illegal transactions to date. This isn't the first time Bombardier has been caught dealing under the table in Eastern Europe, either. In 2017, a representative of the company was indicted in Sweden for wiring millions of dollars to officials in Azerbaijan as bribery to secure railway contracts. Bombardier ended up winning the contract, and the manager was eventually acquitted and emigrated to Russia before his second trial began. Investigators also believe that more bribes were sent to Azerbaijan through another offshore company affiliated with Bombardier. So far, Bombardier has denied that any part of its dealing with the Virgin Islands shell company was illegal, and it has stated no intention to stop doing business with offshore holding companies. Will Anderson for Groundwire.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
So the mirror poets laugh from the serpent's ruptured wrath. They finger at the monarch with destruction blush. Oh, but I can hardly see them where their saintly diadem. I implore my preservation deep inside the empty hearts. And I am not afraid, no mirror, I am not afraid. Though the molecules of time have cast the sunshine to the shade. I am not afraid, no mirror, I am not afraid. There'll be truth blooms in the willows in the morning.
You are listening to Groundwire Community Radio News, available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. You just heard Empty Husk by Daniel Romano from the album Finally Free. Now it's time for our feature stories. Our first feature is a continuation of CKUW's ongoing reporting on the proposal to operate a major sand mining facility 210 kilometers north of Winnipeg on the east side of Lake Winnipeg for use in fracking operations across the continent.
This is my home. I don't want my home to be bulldozed and the land and the environment to be destroyed. But once they start, that's it. We're done. It's gone.
That was Reg Simard, a homeowner living in Manigatagan and a member of Hollow Water First Nation, putting forward his concerns about a proposed silica sand mining project which will impact the health and well-being of himself and his neighbors once operations are underway. He was speaking alongside opposition MLA Rob Altemeyer and members of the group What the Frack Manitoba, during a February 27th press conference just outside the office of Minister of Sustainable Development, Rochelle Squires. Members of the group are demanding answers from the province, concerned that the Palliser government has irresponsibly issued a work permit to Canadian Premium Sands, the company planning to mine 1 million tons a year of silica sand from the Seymourville deposit near three Indigenous communities north of Winnipeg, and transport it to major fracking operations across North America. CPS has already authorized site clearing work on an access road to a registered community trapline area utilized by the people of Hollow Water First Nation. What the Frack argues that granting a permit before Section 35 community consultations have been concluded would be a clear violation of rights guaranteed to Indigenous peoples under the Constitution.
Don Sullivan, I'm with What the Frack Manitoba. I was also a former special advisor to the government of Manitoba on the Pamachuanaki World Heritage Site, Queen Golden Jubilee Medal recipient, and a landscape photographer. The Section 35 consultation is supposed to be undertaken by the Crown, not by the company, not by Chief and Council. It's supposed to be the Crown. The lead Crown currently is the province of Manitoba. There has not been one Crown representative at any of the consultation meetings to date. In fact, the person who's running the consultation meetings is a former band member who was one of the original signatories to the MOU between the company and Hollow Water First Nations. So this is, you know, this is a farce. It's a coercive process that is designed to coerce the community into supporting the project. Is basically what it is.
My name is Tara Williamson. I'm a member of the Opasquat Cree Nation, and I was raised in Gabashkigamug, Swan Lake, Manitoba. I was on faculty here at the U of W last year in Indigenous Studies. I've also I teach at Ryerson. I've taught at Trent University, Fleming College, and my background is in, I have a Bachelor of Social Work degree, a law degree, and a Master's in Indigenous Governance. What we've seen in the last few years is corporations suing the government and winning. They showed up, they were told they could go into business, they could do whatever it is they wanted to do, and then they got there and, you know, were met with resistance by communities and suddenly realized they couldn't go ahead with these projects. And so they brought the government to court and said, you owe us money for wasting our time, essentially. So I think a corporation who's willing to go into a community and take the quick, easy route, that's a red flag to me.
The company has submitted their Environment Act proposal, and the province's Technical Advisory Committee has had a chance to review that proposal. In public documents about the plan, the TAC has raised concerns around air quality from silica dust, higher impacts on wildlife, hunting, species at risk, and traditional lands use, groundwater management concerns, the potential for acid leaching, and potential heavy metals contamination, and the need to undertake a traffic impact study due to the high volume of trucks traveling along Manitoba highways as part of the project's daily operations.
A national instrument report is a compliance report, which all mining companies trading on the stock exchange in Canada must file. So essentially, it's the most accurate information because there are repercussions legally for not being in compliance on what you're saying in those reports. We compared what they were saying in the Environmental Act proposal to their 2014 National Instruments Compliance Report. Numerous inconsistency of what they're telling not only the regulators, but to the communities and to the rest of the public about what this operation is and what's involved. Then they tell us, back in October, we're going to file a new National Instruments Report in December of 2018, but that didn't happen. Then, on February 22nd of this year, they issued another press release saying that they will not be filing their National Instrument Compliancy Report until April or June of 2019. This will be well after the Director of Environmental Approvals for the province makes certain irrevocable decisions about whether to issue this license or not based on the information that the company has provided. So it's extremely egregiously deceptive behavior on the company. As far as I'm concerned, they could have filed this report back in December as they promised. But no, they've chosen to hold on to that information. And why? Well, obviously, they must have something to hide or they would have filed this report.
In an email to CKUW, a provincial spokesperson stated that, quote, CPS has been doing work under an approved permit for preliminary geotechnical and exploration work, which is a normal process and permitted in the early stages for any project, unquote. What the FRAC maintains, however, that the work referred to by the province does not include clearing the site, but rather the drilling and assessing of the geological character of the deposit, what the FRAC claims the government is continuing to be evasive. In response to a question about concerns raised by members of Hollow Water First Nation about an improper consultation process, the provincial spokesperson merely replied that, quote, Hollow Water First Nation Chief Larry Barker has expressed support for the project, unquote. Adding to the procedural concerns is an audited financial statement for the company detailing how Canadian Premium Sands gave the band $250,000 upon reaching an economic partnership agreement back in late November, with the promise of more to come. All this before Section 35 consultations commenced. Meanwhile, what the FRAC Manitoba is continuing to demand, a full federal-provincial joint panel review of the proposed project with expert interveners to properly assess all the hazards associated with the project. In our next feature, this past Friday was International Women's Day and events took place around the world to celebrate. The organizers of the annual march in Montreal, however, have begun to see fundamental issues in how the mindset of International Women's Day is changing. Will Anderson of CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal reports.
Dolores Chu is a member of the South Asian Women's Community Center in Montreal, which is a founding member of Women of Diverse Origin, a local coalition and collective that organizes the annual International Women's Day March in Montreal. She expressed what her organization believes are growing issues within the practice of International Women's Day.
Well, you know, the International Women's Day began as International Working Women's Day with women like Clara Zetkin in Europe putting out this call and remembering, you know, women like the ones who worked in the shirtwaist industry in New York who died in the fire in the factory. And so it started out very much as a day to mark the struggle for women to live with equality, focused on working women, working class women. But over the years, and that's a good thing, it's sort of becoming wider and more broad-based. But again, this year, there seems to be a sense that it's getting co-opted and becoming a little bit like Valentine's Day. And so particularly among, you know, French Quebecers, the day is sort of being renamed now Journée Internationale des Droits des Femmes à Montréal. And so sort of the focusing on women's rights. And I think that's always a struggle, particularly for those of us in women of diverse origins. The reason we got together in 2002 to start organizing was we wanted to have a Women's Day March in Montreal because for many years there hadn't been one. And when there was sort of a marking of the day, it tended to be done by unions, and the issues of particularly women coming from marginalized or racialized communities were not heard. And so we wanted to be visible. We wanted our voices to be heard. And we also wanted to reclaim the sort of militant tradition of International Women's Day. And so that's what we've tried to do over the years. And hopefully we're still doing it.
Chu also described some of the new values that her organization would impart year to year in the Women's Day March.
So historically, there had been a kind of a militant Women's Day tradition in Montreal with a march, and then it kind of sort of died out. And there were some events marking Women's Day at times. You know, there would be trade unions organizing, but it wasn't as feminist as we would have liked it to be, and it didn't bring out issues of racialized communities or women who were newer immigrants dealing with issues of status, of employment exploitation.
The march did proceed on Friday, March 8th, International Women's Day in Montreal, as did other marches around the world. Further protesters were at the hearing for Gilbert Rozon, founder of the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival, who is at the center of sexual assault allegations. Will Anderson for Groundwire.
You're still listening to Groundwire, community news broadcasting from coast to coast to coast and available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. Now it's time for our community radio report. As reported in the last installment of Groundwire, Ontario-based campus radio stations are reeling from plans by the Ford government to allow post-secondary students the ability to effectively opt out of student services, such as campus radio. Ryerson University station CJRU 1280 AM is particularly concerned about the impacts these changes will have and are bracing for the expected changes. CJRU is playing host to the upcoming 2019 National Community Radio Conference, and among the highlights will be a rally against the Student Choice Initiative. For this week's Community Radio Report, Groundwire got hold of one of the programmers at CJRU and got her perspective on how the station was coping with planned changes.
I'm Elizabeth Boyd. I am the news producer at CJRU 1280 AM in Toronto. Our station is at Ryerson University. We have programming for the community here in Toronto and also at Ryerson. I help with the news show, which is the Scope News, and also a bunch of other programs like Fem Radio, which is a feminist hour, and one called the Ear Opener. And there are lots of other ones. We do a lot of music at this station as well for Canadian artists and Toronto artists and things like that. And we do a lot of partnerships. Up until last year, we did a program called Youth Radio United, which was with the Ontario Provincial Advocate for Children and Youth. And I was very thankful to be a part of that, which gives like youth voices. So like kids, or not kids, but young adults can come on the radio and talk about what interests them and what's important to them, and have that actually be youth directed for youth. And so we run a lot of programs like that. We have a radio camp, and we try and really service for the community mostly. the Ford government has introduced that you can opt out of ancillary fees at all post-secondary institutions in Ontario, which is really detrimental to our station because most of our funding comes from students. And I don't think that students pay a lot every year to support our station, but it's one of those things where once they have the option to opt out, I guess a lot of students take that. And we don't rely on a lot of sponsorships or a lot of advertisements. We actually have very little advertisements on our show because we are a community radio station. And so basically what it means is that, like, our manager is taking some leave to try and help save some money, and we're closing the station in the summer a lot. For me, like, I was supposed to have a job here in the summertime, and now I can't have that, and because we just simply don't have the money, and we have to save that money for next year to try and keep us open. My programs, instead of weekly shows, I'm having to do bi-weekly shows to also try and save a bit of money. I get a small honorarium for producing shows. It's not a lot of money, but it helps to just keep things going, and so that I can continue to pay my rent and still contribute and still get experience and paid experience, I guess, while I'm in school, which is really amazing. So things like that will be really hard. And worst case scenario, we might actually have to close down in September and in the future, which is not good, obviously. We're also trying to talk to the administration to be deemed as an essential service, because we do put out things like Amber Alerts and security alerts on campus and in the community. And a lot of people don't actually realize that we're here on campus, and they don't really realize that we have a radio station. And so I guess we're a little afraid that people won't think that we're actually essential because they don't hear these alerts on these things, whereas there are a lot of people in the community who maybe don't have cell phones to get their Amber Alerts, and so they do need to rely on radios or something like that, and we can provide that.
How is CJRU fighting back against these potential cuts in revenue?
We have banded with the Canadian Federation of Students Ontario, and they've started like a bit of a campaign to get together a bunch of like student union groups. So like CJRU and our campus newspaper, the Eye Opener, and like other places on campus. So we're trying to get together and have people sign petitions to say that campus media is essential, and try and fight back on these four things. There's not much that we can do other than that and talk to the Ryerson administration. We're also trying to collect sponsor statements from our listeners, and if we can collect enough of those, then maybe we can take them to the administration and see like how valuable campus radio is.
Could you give us some background on a scandal involving the Ryerson Student Union and where it connects with the plan to opt out of student services like campus media?
Right after it broke that, I guess, the Ford government was removing ancillary fees and making a bunch of changes to OSAP and things like that, our campus newspaper, the Eye Opener, broke the story that our student union on campus has spent thousands and thousands of dollars on things like Airbnbs and booze and just things that are definitely not for students. And they were just partying and using the money and bringing us more and more in debt and taking that from students. And even now, the new student union, now that the old president has been impeached and all of this chaos is happening now, the student union is dipping into things like dental plans and things like the Eye Opener's budget, like the newspaper's budget. And I don't know if they're dipping into CJRU, but this is kind of just the tip of the story that we've uncovered, that they're trying to break into those budgets just to rebalance the budget and make it seem like they have a balanced budget when they don't actually, and pay off that over time. And so things like that makes it a little harder for students to look at their fees and say, that they really do want to keep paying for these fees. Even Doug Ford, our premier, responded to the events and said that, like, this is why I'm taking away student ancillary fees. And I guess it's a lot of drama. But it's sad because it means that a lot of people on campus won't be necessarily wanting to give their money to the student unions again.
CJRU reported on a protest which took place January 25th in opposition to the cuts. Here's a couple of the voices that they recorded.
Education is a right! Education is a right!
So I use OSAP, and one of the big things that is an issue for me is that I'm not going to be considered an independent anymore, even though I graduated in 2014. So they'll still consider, like, my parents' income, and that means that I'll receive less tuition. Already living in Toronto is insanely expensive, and 10% off tuition is not going to be anywhere near equal to what having the tuition grant is, basically.
It's just shocking. I think it's going to make the student experience more geared towards people who already have access to all of those things, like outside the campus, and it's going to reduce access on campus for people who don't have easy access to that stuff.
So we're here with the Canadian Federation of Students, as well as March for Education, and a number of students here to really tell the government that they picked a fight with the wrong people, and students are not going to give up on the fact that they've cut major grants that students rely on to go to post-secondary education.
We have our social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at CJRU1280. And if you would like to support us, we post things like support statements that you can tell us why you think that we are an important station to stay on air, or if you can get us in contact with regular advertisements or sponsorships, it would really help us to keep doing what we do and keep our station open and options for student journalists like me who need to get experience working at a radio station for, like, future jobs and things like that, and I guess other people just to be able to listen to community radio.
That was our community radio report. Up next, a short musical break. Just heard Earth by Trampoline from the 2019 album Happy Crimes. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota. Headlines this week were contributed by Michael Welch, Catherine Fisher, and Will Anderson. Music this week was from Daniel Romano and Trampoline. For CKUW 95.9 FM, this has been Michael Welch. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca. Thanks for tuning in.